boasts hundreds of millions of users or more. But the social media age has as many drawbacks for Muslims as it does benefits. We'll get into that with our studio guests in just a minute. But first, we hit the streets of London this week to ask ordinary Muslims for their views as well.
I grew up on social media. I think I started in 2018. I built a following of 420,000 followers on TikTok, but I got like severely depressed because although you're kind of growing up yourself, you also grow up with other people and you feel like they have a huge impact on your life and you feel like you can't really do anything right. And I feel like having those followers did kind of influence the person that I became. Haram is very normalized, and when you do like halal things, it's not so much normalized. So it was kind of really difficult to find like the perfect balance. But when I stopped like doing certain things on social media, I lost a lot of followers. And I think on my mental health, I just kind of didn't really understand, because I thought I did something good. Obviously I did something good like religiously, but I didn't really understand why people didn't like it. So that's what made me see social media a little bit differently. It made me realize that the people that are supporting you aren't necessarily the people you want to be supporting you. I was literally seeking validation from the creation, not the creator, astaghfirullah. But it's a blessing in disguise, alhamdulillah, because I needed that push, like, to put on my hijab.
I think it can be used for good things most of the time. It just depends on what you follow and who you interact with on social media yourself. I would say for little kids, they get influenced easily. But for me, I usually follow, for example, people that post about their jobs or they post about medicine-related stuff, etc. So it's good for me. For a lot of people, whatever's happening in Sudan, a lot of news outlets are not maybe saying a lot of things that you can see on social media, because there's a lot of people that are in the situation themselves that are posting about, etc. But most of the time, you can find misinformation. A lot of misinformation, and then other people have to come out and say, okay, this is not true. I think it's good, because a lot of the times I did not hear about Palestine, etc., what's happening on, like, for example, CNN, BBC, they're not really reporting the truth about it. But on social media, especially TikTok, you keep going on and then the news keeps going, but sometimes it's hard to filter out what is right and what is wrong.
Someone said to me, like, what is your standard of beauty? Like, what do you think beauty is? I was like, I don't know, Kim Kardashian, like, small nose, massive lips. And they were like, no, that's so wrong. And they were like to me, until you see beauty as modesty, you will never see beauty in modesty. And that night I put on the hijab. Yeah. Alhamdulillah. I used to like just do pranks on my parents, and then I gained like 100k in one day because the prank went viral, got like 4 million views. But back in 2019, it was a lot more easier to gain like traction on social media. But now I just do like dawah Islamic content, and alhamdulillah, even though I have less like views, the hasanat is a lot greater in the akhirah, inshallah.
Joining us today to talk about Islam, Muslims and social media, we have two esteemed guests. Paul Williams runs the Blogging Theology social media platform, which has hundreds of thousands of followers. Blogging Theology features a regular cast of high-profile guests discussing Islam mostly, but also other Abrahamic faiths too. And Noor Fekri is a business owner and politics graduate with a keen interest in the Middle East. She has successfully used social media to shine a light on religious and political events in a way that is easily accessible to the everyday person. Welcome to the show, both of you. Paul, you've been on the show before, so I'll come straight to you. Nice to have you back, of course. Just tell me, obviously, you've been on social media a while now. You're quite a well-established brand, especially here in the UK. Tell me about your experience. How have you found it navigating the world of social media?
I think overwhelmingly it's been very positive for me, actually. And in a sense, I'm glad I've come to social media later in life, because I bring kind of experience from the real world into social media. So I try and avoid obvious pitfalls like getting into arguments or being sick. So I try and focus on what I do, and I try and do what I do better each day, and rather than getting involved in disputes and arguments, which I have done in the past, mainly at Speaker's Corner, but online, I focus on the work, and alhamdulillah, blessing from God, it's been a very good experience so far.
But surely you've come across some of the negative aspects, yep. The fact that even if you avoid the toxic, like the debates, the arguments, that type of thing, I mean, the fact that you have a large following now, people look to you for information and for knowledge, and they enjoy your content, they'll probably pay you quite a regular bunch of compliments, I dare say, Paul. How have you handled that? Do you think it's changed you in any way?
Yes, that's a very good point, because there can be problems to do with success rather than just bad experiences. So I have had a lot of praise, and that is difficult to deal with. I find it difficult to deal with, because that's a test for me in terms of the challenges to be arrogant or egotistical. So I'm very conscious where the blessing has come from, and I try and always remember that comes from God. And also, it could disappear at any moment. You know, the plug could be pulled on the channel, or I could get run over by a bus or something. So I'm aware that it's provisional, but it's a blessing. And also, it's a service. I see what I do now much more as a service to the Ummah rather than an extension of a personal hobby, which it was originally. You know, oh, I find this interesting, I'll just do something about it. Now I'm aware that it has that kind of service dimension to it.
Noor, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on, first time appearance. Now, just tell me about your experience on social media, because I like the fact that obviously you're young, you're also a sister as well, so your experience is probably quite different to, say, mine or Paul's, who we're used to. I mean, when I first came on social media, it was MySpace. I don't know if you even remember MySpace, MSN, and now it's changed quite a lot to the point where we have TikTok now, brand new platforms, which are a new challenge, which I know you're on as well. Just tell me, what's your experience been like?
So I think my experience is very interesting. I sort of fell into posting videos on social media. It wasn't out of choice. It was more like during my pilgrimage to for the Edinburgh, during the Edinburgh pilgrimage, I posted a video about my journey, and that sort of went viral. And I think that's what's interesting about TikTok and makes it so different to all the other platforms, is that the algorithm sort of works a little bit differently, and you can go viral quite easily. Mm. And once I gained that following, I think around 20,000 followers, albeit in Baghdad or wherever, but you know, that I then realized that, you know, the power of that and being able to push sort of positive content in terms of my political activism, and I saw that as a, you know, fantastic opportunity. So actually my experience has been very positive. I think it's a little bit different as a woman posting content on social media. You don't necessarily get the compliments that you might get. Instead, you have people asking you to sort of take down your videos, and that, you know, women shouldn't be involved in sort of outward political activism and sort of showing your face. You know, women can sort of use other platforms like writing. But I think it's really important for us to utilise the tools that we have at our disposal, which, you know, in this day and age is TikTok, is Instagram Reels, and in terms of me being a woman and sort of show my face, I mean, I believe that it is everyone's Islamic duty to be involved in some sort of social and political activism. I don't think it should be limited in terms of me being a woman.
You've said some really interesting stuff there, and what also interested me is what one of the other sisters out in the streets of London mentioned. She said that she went very viral. Mm-hmm. She was getting millions of views, loads of followers. I think it was on TikTok, I can't remember. But she also said that she started to experience depression. Mm-hmm. She felt like she was chasing the creation rather than the creator. Mm-hmm. So she became addicted to getting those views, going viral. She was doing pranks on her parents. Mm-hmm. I think she was from an Arab background, and that's not traditional. To prank your parents is a bit disrespectful, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm going too far there. Yeah. But those seem to be challenges. Mm-hmm. She was initially interested in going viral. Then it started to have a negative effect on her personality, on her life.
Yeah.
How would you respond to that?
I mean, it's a shame that she had to experience that. But it's really easy to fall into those traps, and it's really important for us as Muslims to be aware of that, and be aware that these social media platforms, you know, first understand who owns these platforms. So, for example, with Twitter, it's, you know, quite recently Elon Musk, and we've got Facebook and Instagram by Mark Zuckerberg. These are all Western either companies or individuals, so they'll have a particular agenda that they're trying to, you know, being on these social media platforms in and of itself is a challenge for us Muslims. So you're entering essentially the enemy's territory. That is their territory. You're entering it. You need to understand how to navigate it and not fall into the traps of sort of, you know, this influencer culture whereby you're entirely consumed by these hijabi influencers that will teach you sort of how to dress modestly whilst simultaneously being modest. It's really important not to fall into that trap.
I'm going to come back to you, Noor, but I want to get Paul before we go on to the next part of the show. Mm-hmm. Paul, I wouldn't be going into an environment which is like a drinking environment, like a pub, for example. You wouldn't see me walking into a pub anymore because I know, inshallah, no, because obviously I know that there'll be haram activities going on in there. Mm. I'll be in an environment which perhaps I'll be tempted to do something which Islam doesn't condone. So I won't go there. Mm. I'll make the right decision and not bother going there. Mm. With social media, however, it seems as if people are making the decision to go in, knowing that they're going to see haram stuff. They're doing it anyway, and then they try to justify it by saying, well, no, actually, I'm doing something good for Islam. Mm. How can that be justified, Paul?
I think it can be justified. I mean, it's an online public square, so it's not like a pub where you have to specifically go to a specific building. I think, as I say, social media is like an online version of the world, and a lot of us inhabit that. So there's a lot of good online, and a lot of evil online, a lot of other just rubbish online as well. Mm. And what I try and do, I try and keep my head down and focus as much as I can, by the grace of God, on producing good content.
It's a bit hard not to do a bit of side-eyeing, though. For the zombie scrolling feature, something could pop
maybe it's me, but I don't. Zombie scrolling is just leaves me dead. I mean, pun intended. I mean, you know, 5 seconds and I'm bored. You know, I rush off and grab a book because I'm a bit addicted to books. My addiction, by the way, is not to TikTok; it's to books. And you know, like I breathe and eat, I have to read. It's just who I am. So I have a different kind of addiction.
To add to this discussion, we spoke with another prominent Muslim social media content producer known by his digital name, That Muslim Guy. That Muslim Guy has gone viral multiple times for his content challenging the anti-Muslim stereotypes routinely peddled by mainstream media. Here's what he had to say on the subject.
So far, I've been on social media for approximately 6 years or so, and it is a mixed bag. Of course, as with everything, social media is a very powerful tool, and I compare it to being the printing press of our day and age. And it's like any other tool, any other technology. It's all about how you use it. It could be used to cause good, could be used to cause harm. And for me, it's been a net positive, but it has come with a lot of challenges, and we have to learn how to manage the challenges and put controls in place in order to turn it into a net positive and not fall victim to the many cons that are associated with social media. So just to be clear, whenever we talk about addiction is anything that essentially it's very difficult to stop. It's impacting your life in a negative manner, maybe those around you. And social media is definitely an addiction, whether we like to admit it or not. At the end of the day, no matter how much we try to keep our youth away from social media, like Instagram and Facebook, although youth aren't really using Facebook as much, Instagram, TikTok, no matter what we do, they're going to go to school. They're going to go to work. They're going to go to university. They're going to go wherever, see their friends, and they'll be exposed to it. So the best we could do is to ensure that we educate the youth, our children, the next generation, as to the pros and the cons of media. And there are many dangers. There are pros, but there are many dangers. So the key is education, giving them an Islamic education. Know that there is a lot of haram on these social media platforms. At what age do you allow them to use social media? Now that comes down to the individual parents. Personally, I say the youth are on there anyways. And if we do not go on there as well to counter that narrative, that agenda, whether it's the nudity, whether it's the sexual content, whether it's the Islamophobia being spread on those platforms, if we don't have a presence there, then we can't reclaim the narrative in any way, shape, or form. And the youth that's already on there and we can't do anything about it, they're just going to be exposed to all that negativity and non-activity. So at the very end of the day, it comes down to your individual intentions, of course, but if you want to do da'wah, you have to use the printing press of today's day and age. Personally, I think this can be divided into two main things. There's the people who achieve great success, and they get all the likes, all the engagements and everything, and then that becomes an addiction, and you want more of it. So then you start off initially talking about Islamic content, and the intentions are righteous, and then you fall victim to this, I need more likes, I need more views, and you start going down that path, essentially, whereby it's just about the views at this point, doesn't matter what I talk about, and you unfortunately move away from your deen, and you fall into depression, and you fall victim to that lifestyle. Then there's the other end of the spectrum, and that's when you're not getting the views. There's no instant fame. It's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years of hard work, you're grinding, and nothing. 20 views, 50 views, 3 likes. What am I even doing this for? And then that's a struggle in and of itself, and you also fall into some sort of depression there. Is this even worth it? So the point becomes, go back to your intentions, and the results are with Allah. And the main thing I can compare that to is, look at prophets and messengers. Like Nuh alayhi salam, Prophet Noah, peace be upon him. How many years, 950 years, he preached to his people? And how many followers did he have? scholars differ on the number, but it's very, very little. Does that mean he wasn't a great prophet? Does that mean he didn't do his, he didn't work as hard as he can to preach his people? No. We control our work, our intention. Allah controls the results. So always remember your intention when you are experiencing either this fame or this seemingly you're not going anywhere. And what's the point?
Well, you've heard from Mohammed there, and let's come back to our discussion in the studio. Now, Noor, I'm going to come back to you because I want to tell you very briefly a story which I saw very recently on social media. It happened on Twitter. There was a sister who posted an Eid Day celebration picture of herself. Now, I didn't see the picture. I think that she was young, good-looking sister, mashallah. And unfortunately, she began to get trolled. She was trolled routinely. There was inappropriate comments being made by non-Muslims about her. The picture went viral. Then she started getting attacked from Muslims who were like, how dare she put a picture up? Look what's happened. She's now being shamed and embarrassed and disgraced. She then ended up deleting her profile, deleting the picture. She's now disappeared from social media completely. I assume that's she's had an awful experience. I can only imagine. Mm. So just that's an example of where social media has gone wrong, very badly wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a risk that even you're making, surely, by just being on there. Mm-hmm. A day could come where something happens which puts you in the spotlight. You could go viral for something negative. Mm-hmm. You could say something wrong, and then there you go, you're in trouble. So just tell me, how again, do you feel that we as Muslims, Muslim sisters, can handle this type of danger?
I think we need to be really calculated in our approach. So when we're entering these spaces, again, like I said, we're entering the enemy's territory. So, you know, not posting just any random content, not falling into the traps of posting images, you know, to feed into that sort of capitalist ideology, you know. We had numerous sort of hijabi influencers that were, the algorithm would push them so far, and it would get so many followers for sort of, you know, promoting hijabi modest streetwear, and then they proceeded to remove their hijab, you know, a couple of years later, and in turn, a lot of women then also removed their hijab.
Do you think that that was social media that led them to that decision? Would you blame social media for that?
Yeah, I mean, there was an obvious trend. There was an obvious wave of these social media influencers removing their hijab all at the same time. Mm. So I do believe that social media had a massive role to play in that. But also, it's interesting because there's a massive double standard here. So the West will sort of push that kind of content whilst at the same time demonizing Muslims on, for example, mainstream media outlets.
So this is what I would say then, potentially. I could say that social media is not a safe space for my daughters. It's not a safe space for you. You shouldn't be on there. You could get drawn into a negative worldview. You could end up removing your hijab. Yeah. What would you say to that?
So I would say that, unfortunately, this is our reality. So we, as Muslims, we shouldn't sort of run away from our reality. Social media is the reality now. Mm-hmm. And there's no use in us sort of hiding away and sort of trying not to be involved in this reality. Instead, we should try and utilize the tools at our disposal to try and to be a force for good on social media, rather than sort of shying away from and being involved out of fear. You know, and whether we like it or not, we have to be involved. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of sort of as well establishing putting in guidelines as to how we should be involved, and sort of educating each other within our communities, and also recognizing talent within our communities. We've some people that sort of can put together a fantastic essay within 20 minutes, and then you've got others that can articulate themselves really well in a 1 minute TikTok video, and being able to sort of support each other into the right avenues, and also not really idealizing a particular person, like a particular activist, and making them a celebrity, so that when they do get attacked or taken down or deplatformed or silenced, that the whole movement stops. Instead, we should mobilise and sort of do, you know, it should be a movement that is done all together.
That is a very good point you mentioned. I'm going to throw that at Paul, actually. The fact that there are big egos now that are built up. I'll admit, I'm a bit of an addict. I'm a social media addict. I'm not afraid to say it. I'm on Twitter all the time. I'm even on TikTok and YouTube. You know, it's hard not to be these days, as I think Noor mentioned in her point. But it's very difficult not to become a bit of a narcissist. Obviously, I'll be receiving compliments. My ego's going to grow. I'm going to get a big head from all this. And I think that there is a legitimate issue here of people going online with good intentions, maybe doing a bit of dawah activism, that type of thing, and then all of a sudden they become these big personalities. They're like celebrities. They get treated differently. They start to act differently. I've seen this happen many, many times. Tell me, Paul, how dangerous is this?
It's a real danger. The Quran talks about life being a test, and there are different kinds of tests, and this is a test for us who on social media who achieve some measure of success, and that is how to deal with that in terms of vanity and egotism and so on. And absolutely, I'm acutely aware of that, and I have a little motto on my screen, but it partly involves, you know, remembering to be humble, remembering where success comes from, remember where my money comes from, where everything comes from. It's not coming out of my own cleverness. It's a gift from God. It's all from God. So it's a challenge to being Muslim, actually, a good Muslim.
It is a challenge, but what worries me is that there are a lot of people online now that are doing dawah. They're trying to represent Islam, and they're self-styling themselves as ambassadors for the religion. And we don't know where these people have been educated. We don't know if they're qualified to do so. They start lecturing others on how to behave them. Sometimes it turns out that they're not behaving as they lecture people in their own private lives. So do you think that perhaps some of this activism online is actually doing more damage than
absolutely
good?
There's an awful lot of toxic egotism going on. I think I can only say is find reliable sources of information, reliable scholars or reputable people like Hamza Zoltzer, so I can drop names, and Sapiens Institute. Follow reliable, acknowledged people who've got a track record of being mainstream normative Muslims, and follow them and follow their advice about what books to read and who else to listen to. So don't go running off on your own, and you know, follow the mainstream and look to the mainstream scholars and people like Hamza Zoltzer, and I don't think you'll go wrong then.
Noor, I want to ask you a bit about challenges the Muslims will find, not just for themselves dealing with the platform, but also the fact that there's like a lot of Islamophobic content out there. You mentioned earlier that there's a lot of anti-Muslim stories that will go much more viral, be shared a lot more than, say, positive stories about Muslims. So in a way, I guess you could argue that Muslims need to be online to combat this anti-Muslim trend. But do you think that it's actually an effective way of fighting back?
I do think it is an effective way of fighting back. I mean, if we compare it to previously, we only sort of had mainstream media outlets, and that was the only option available. Whereas now social media can kind of be seen as a more level ground, and we can all engage, and we can all have a platform, albeit, of course, with, you know, despite it being owned by Western sort of either companies or individuals, they're always going to have the upper hand. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't engage in these platforms altogether. I mean, we've seen some real tangible change on the ground happening through these social media sort of campaigns. We've had the safe Sheikh Jarrah campaign that happened, for example, whereby there was a Twitter storm and everyone sort of contributed to that. And although, I mean, and at the time the expulsions were halted, and although that might not be the, you know, a huge political event, it's not like we liberated Palestine, for example, but you can see how that can actually, you know, our involvement in social media can actually have real tangible change on the ground. And as well, like I said, there's a massive double standard in that, you know, they'll push content that sort of feeds into that capitalist ideology, whereas, you know, they will demonize Muslims on mainstream media and sort of, you know, show us images of terrorists and ISIS and sort of associate that with Muslims to try and dehumanize them and then justify, you know, invading their countries, for example. So, yeah, it's a tool at our disposal that we should be making use of without falling into the traps.
I know from my own personal experience that I tend not to look at the views. You know, I think people get obsessed with views. They make clickbait content. They start to get accused of acting a certain way because they're trying to get people to watch. I just produce it. Do I like it?
Yes.
That's good enough for me.
Don't
exactly look at the views. Yes. Just post your content. If you've got something interesting to say, put it out there.
Exactly.
That's it. Just don't focus on that.
Exactly.
And hopefully you'll have a better experience, inshallah. Well, thank you very much to both of you. But unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you to our guests. And for you at home, join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
Muscle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
Leader meets with thousands of workers and members of labour organisations. On Saturday, 29th of April 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, met with thousands of workers, members of labor organizations, and officials from Iran's Ministry of Cooperatives, Labor, and Social Welfare at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran. The meeting took place as we approach 1st of May, which has been designated as International Workers' Day. Here in the Islamic Republic of Iran, 1st of May also marks Workers' Day and Workers' Week. In this program, we discuss the leaders' points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. On Saturday, 29th of April 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution met with thousands of workers from all walks of life, both men and women, employed in various sectors of Iran's economy, who had traveled to this meeting from every corner of the Islamic Republic of Iran. To begin with, Ayatollah Khamenei said the purpose of this meeting was to highlight the importance of workers and the great value of their work and how important workers were to society. The leader emphasized the culture of work, how important it is to respect the rights of workers and to fully appreciate the value of workers and the work that they do. In Islam, work can be viewed as a way of attaining proximity to the Almighty, and hard work is valued just as much as great worship of the Lord. A hadith from the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Whoever manages to provide for his or her own living expenses through honest hard work, he or she will stand behind prophets of God and will benefit just as prophets of God will benefit on the Day of Judgment." Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader said, "I want to talk about the value of workers in our society. What I want is for people to realize how valuable our workers are. The term worker has a broad definition. The workers I'm talking about now are the laborers in industrial and agricultural settings, those who provide services and so on and so forth. I'm not addressing researchers, university professors and the such. They too are workers in a way, but they're not the ones that I'm addressing right now. Rather, it is you, the country's community of labourers. I want to talk about work, workers, and the responsibilities that we all have towards them. Firstly, how can we understand the importance of workers? From the importance of the work that they do, of course. Why is work important in society? You can understand the importance of workers from the importance of the work that they do. Work is what keeps a society alive. Work is the backbone of people's lives. Without work, there is nothing. The food we eat, the clothes we wear, the facilities that we use, that our lives depend upon, all of these have been attained through work. But who does this work? Well, workers, of course. So what is the value of a worker? The value of a worker is equal to the value of a society's existence. They're equal to the value of people's lives." In further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "If no work is done in society, all these national assets will remain stagnant. We have mines, we have facilities, we have soil and water. If work is done, all of these things will be blessings. The mines will be worked upon, water and soil will be utilized, and life will continue. However, if no work is done, these natural resources will remain dormant and unutilized. Therefore, work is what makes our potential flourish. That is the significance of work. Once we understand the importance of work, that's when we realize how important a worker is. This is one point, and we must, first of all, have this knowledge about ourselves, about our workers and their communities. Commenting further, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "We should realize the importance of creating jobs and employment. The creation of jobs is important for various reasons. First of all, the country needs jobs. Our society needs to have work. And like I said before, if there is no work, there is no life. Secondly, a worker needs a job in order to run his or her life. Thirdly, workers have a spiritual and mental need to work. The Almighty God created human beings in such a way that being idle makes them bored. Work brings joy to a person's life. So the need to work is not just physical, it's also spiritual. Spiritually, we also need to work. People need to work. And fourthly, work prevents corruption. Unemployment is a source of corruption. Much of the corruption we see around us is the result of unemployment. Addiction is related to unemployment, corruption is related to unemployment, theft is related to unemployment, divorce and breakup of families is also related to unemployment. So you see, the organizations that are responsible for creating jobs know how important it is for society to truly create work and jobs. They must make investments, and this is another point. Another thing I like to say regarding work is that there should be a direct relationship between income and work. According to the Holy Quran, nothing belongs to a person except what he or she strives for. People's income should be based on their effort, on their work. This is how society should be. This is very difficult to do, but what does this mean? It means that much of this easy money and easy gains are wrong. We need to put a stop to the culture of making easy money in this country. I said that this is a long-term, difficult task to achieve, but it must be done. Much of this use of intermediaries, middlemen, bribery, that is given and received in some places, usury, that is taking place in some economic sectors, and this taking advantage of relationships, resulting in people gaining an easy, hassle-free money without actually working. These are all harmful to society. People's income must be directly earned through hard work. As far as remarks, the leader said, one of the problems we have when it comes to global trade or even our domestic trade is the quality of the products that we manufacture. If workers are reassured and know that they will be able to afford things easily, if they know that they have job security, and if they're confident that their work will get better, the quality of the work that they do will also improve. Everyone should know this. Therefore, any effort to improve a worker's life is actually an effort to improve their work. It is an effort to improve the products that they make and the quality of their work. It is an effort to improve the country. It is an investment. If we try to solve the problems of the community of workers that have actually made an investment, it is not an expense, it is an investment. Everyone should know this. Officials should realize this. in the work that is related to the country's officials, be it government, parliament, or otherwise. Furthermore, the employers, investors, and entrepreneurs and the like also need to realise this point. Production is the backbone of our country. Manufacturing production is the backbone of our country. The backbone of our economy is also manufacturing production. And the backbone of production is, of course, workers. We must not let the worker, just that is, the backbone, become weak. Another point is the need for a fair sharing of the income from work, which we have already discussed. Workers are human capital, and they're more effective than material capital. They create value for products, and this should be taken into consideration. The share of a worker who is skilled, experienced, well-trained and innovative when it comes to creating value for the end product is much greater. His share of the income should therefore be accordingly much greater. Now, this does not mean that we want to challenge investors and the like. No, I don't recommend that at all. Investors, entrepreneurs and workers are all necessary and they're all needed. If one of them is absent, there is nothing that others can do. We need all of them. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, talked about young people. The leader said, "The next group is made up of young people who are not seeking education or work. Our political, social and economic experts need to really sit down and think about this. They should assist the government in this work. They need to help the government and think a way to help this group of young people. Unfortunately, some of our young people don't have jobs, and they're not seeking employment or a higher education. We have a significant number of young people who are in this category. These people are both young, and they're a capital. They're considered an asset, a capital for our country. They should not be wasted. We truly need to come up with a solution for this group of young people. And this is what I have said to experts and to managers, senior managers and government officials." In final remarks, the leader said, "In my view, the community of workers deserves admiration and respect. I truly respect and honour our workers in this country. On the one hand, I believe that, God willing, there needs to be a noticeable change and improvement in the life of workers in this country, considering the hard work that they do. On the other hand, I praise the community of workers from the bottom of my heart because of the way that they have stood up for Iran's economy. And they have helped this country. They have stood up to the enemies of this country as well. I wish you all the best. May Almighty God shower His blessings upon you."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing.
Well, in this program, we answer the questions that you have related to the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who's a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa
rahmatullah. A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor, in a couple of episodes, you have been helping us understand how to deal with boys who are very difficult to handle. And now when it comes to opposite sex, you have been helping us in the previous episode as well. How do we teach our child to deal with the opposite sex, especially boys? Because, you know, Professor, today in a world that we are living in, we have this media propaganda, or we have the movies, or we have everything, whatever is being shown to us through social media, through advertisements, through films, or through any source, through videos, that you should get overexcited when you see the opposite sex. But what is the point of Islam on that?
So, as I said previously also, the relationship between the two sexes of the human beings is very delicate. We have the relationship with a boy, with his mother, with his sister, and then a sister and the cousins outside the immediate family, and then girls outside the family completely. So only those, the mother and the sister, they are mahram. And we said we need to, even being while they are mahram, but they still need to be modest in front of their brothers or their
sisters,
sons. Or they need to be modest. They need to take care of that. Of course, a boy should be able to realize the fact that, yes, even they are mahram, but there has to be certain limits to their interaction with their mothers or their sisters. They need to be, they should have a modest behavior. They should have a reserved behavior as far as many things go. You can't talk to your sisters everything that you can talk to you about with your brothers or with your friends. You can't talk about, you know, about the opposite sex, for example. Unfortunately, sometimes this is happening. That a boy may be discussing,
right,
a brother may be discussing things with his sister, which he shouldn't be doing so. Of course, he can take her advice and she can help him out with a relationship, but not in a way that is not modest. So unfortunately, this is sometimes happening, and there are sisters who are not doing him justice by talking to him in ways which are not proper and appropriate.
Okay. And,
so we need to take care of that relationship. Mothers should also be, you know, careful of how and what they say to their boys. And especially the fathers have a very important role to play. They need to, as I said, they need to be able to, in that situation when the boy is going to face a situation where he's going to come into interaction with the opposite sex, what can be done? He needs to be controlled. He needs to be managed. He needs to be taught how to manage his feelings, because, I mean, of course, you can't expect a person to go towards the fireplace and put his hand on that fireplace and it's not going to get burnt.
Yeah.
The red hot iron is going to burn your hand. So it's the same case with a person, a boy going towards the opposite sex who is not mahram
to him.
And that interaction is going to make you burn
have
you.
The consequences.
So the consequences have to be managed. They have to be controlled. They have to be restricted. And for that, the important thing is that a relationship of confidence and confidentiality should develop between the father and the son, especially.
All right.
Mothers can't do that. The sisters can't.
We'll shed a light on that after a short break, Professor. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Naqvi. Professor, you said that when it comes to boys, and when they reach a stage that they are dealing with opposite sex, fathers play a big role than mothers. How?
Yes, because they have the same sex, basically. I mean,
they're from same gender.
They're from the same gender. The problem, they have faced the similar problems. They have faced a similar situation. They know the problems. And unfortunately, today, in the world today, we are faced with a very difficult situation for Muslims living in the West. They have a difficult situation where their children have to go for sex education at school. And this is a very difficult issue for all Muslims who are living in the West. And they are forced now, they're being forced by the authorities to, for them to attend the classes where this sex education is given.
So when it comes to sex education, do we have problem with the content that is being taught, or do we have problem with the age?
We have both the things. I mean, today the problem is not just sex. It's not just talking about, it's not, they're not saying how to manage the sex relationship in a proper way. It's talking about how to justify wrongdoings, whether it's even same-sex marriage is being justified.
Yeah.
So how to deal with the situation? They're being taught to carry out things which they're not supposed to do according to the teachings of our religion. So the only thing is that we need to be able to preempt that. The father should be able to engage with his son in a way that he feels that the son can confide with his father and talk about these issues. And the age is important. It should be, of course, not a very small age that he's not even concerned with these issues. You can't arouse the feelings of a boy who's 5 to 6 years of age and he doesn't know anything.
Yeah.
But the time he becomes 10, 12, he's the age of what we call, he started to be able to distinguish between things which are good and bad. He may not have the hormones being released yet, but still he is able to distinguish between what is wrong and right in the realm of sexual relationships. So from there, the father should come in and start having a good, friendly interaction with his son.
Yeah.
To develop that, he should be always saying that, I love you, I accept your mistakes. He should be able to teach him being truthful. The important thing is being truthful.
Sincere, truthful.
Let him, at an early age, let him release his energies. Let him play games which are maybe intensive, maybe a little difficult games,
okay,
harsh. Even let him, release that energy.
Okay.
Let him scream out. Let him, at an age where he's not in that age where he's an adolescent. Before that, if that energy is released, even if the father plays with him in such a way, they may wrestle with each other, do boxing with each other,
Help him.
It will help.
Yeah. We'll discuss more with you, Professor, after a short break. Now, listeners, stay tuned.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th Surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Naqvi, and Professor is teaching us something very important, that when boys are to deal with the opposite sex, how we should be dealing with, especially the fathers. Yes, Professor.
So we need, we were saying that we need to develop a relationship, a close relationship with our boys. But fathers have to deal in such a way, play with them, wrestle with them, go play football. I mean, let them release their energy. And then we need to be able to be good listeners, He is true. Make them speak the truth. Let them speak out their hearts. Let them feel that if he's going to relate something wrong, a mistake he may have made, if he's going to be, you know, if he can feel and speak out to his father in a relaxed way, in a confiding way, then he will not have any difficulty in interacting with his father.
Yeah.
Then when it comes to the time, proper time, when the education is to be imparted, the issues that have to relate with the specific sexual limits and relations with the opposite sex, then the father can very easily discuss these issues with his son. And then he can be, you know, make him realize that this situation is there. I understand what you feel, but you need to, you know, manage yourself. You need to be able to
manage your emotions.
You need to release your energies in a positive way. In other ways, carry out alternative sports, intellectual activities, and especially spirituality, and going towards Allah Almighty, reaching out to Allah to help him, to assist him. So you need to help your child in how to do this, how to manage those situations. Talk to him clearly. Apparently, this is what you are. This is you are a boy. You are a grown-up boy. You have your feelings. You have your emotions. I know what you need, but there's a time before you can go for that relationship. You need to manage that situation.
And we are answerable in front of Allah Subhanahu wa Taala for each and every deed that we carry out. And we should not be among those whom Allah will ask tomorrow, مَا غَرَّكَ بِرَبِّكَ الْكَرِيمِ, what was it that ditched you towards your Rabb, who was very Kareem towards you, the Rabb who upbrought you, your Lord, and that too in a very kind way, in a very merciful way. What was it that you preferred someone else over your Lord? Because what happens in these relationships when a person comes in contact with the opposite sex is that he prioritizes the opposite sex over everything blindly.
Exactly. So he needs to understand that, I mean, the father should be very much, he should not be afraid of talking to his son about these issues, and he should be able to talk to him without feeling embarrassed. And so therefore, I mean, when it comes to the ahkam, the orders and commands of Allah Almighty, there should be no embarrassment. We should be very much be explicit about these things. Of course,
Professor, what you are trying to say is that even we kind of have a sex education in Islam, but that has a different content, that has jurisprudence in it, and that has
ethics,
a particular
and
age, that has ethics, that has morals, and that has all the teachings that Islam tells us. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. Thank you so much for giving us such information, especially to the fathers who can actually know now how to deal with their boys. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.